Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. On this program, we had hoped to have a debate between the two candidates for Congress in New York's 24th District and had invited both of them quite some time ago to participate. Unfortunately, Congressman John Katko declined our invitation, despite having readily participated in his two previous elections. As was made clear in the invitations, we are going forward with the candidate who did accept. And so my guest today is Dana Balter, who is the Democrat challenging the Republican incumbent. The 24th District includes all of Cayuga, Onondaga, and Wayne counties, and the western portion of Oswego County, including the city of Oswego. I should note that Ms. Balter has been a visiting professor at the Maxwell School of Syracuse University, where I also teach, and we'll return to that title of hers in a minute. Ms. Balter and I have met before here at the school, but we do not know each other beyond her previous appearance on this program, and we have not worked together. So, Dana, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Grant.
And thanks for agreeing to a debate, even though that debate didn't happen. Now, if this were a debate, we might start by discussing some of the messaging in the campaign, particularly if it were negative and attack-oriented. And we've done this in previous debates. Again, this isn't a debate, but your opponent's campaign has been, I think it's fair to say, pretty negative and attack-oriented in much of its messaging. And so I wanted to give you a chance to respond to some of the claims being made there. I also have some questions about some of your claims, but let me start with these. And let's start with the one that we've heard over and over again. I think if people know nothing else about you in this district, they probably know that you are a visiting assistant professor, or were, at Syracuse University. The obvious implication of this being that you're not really rooted here, you're just visiting. So, first of all, could you explain to our listeners what being a visiting assistant professor means at a university? The title has a particular meaning.
It does. It's a non-tenure track position, and it's a year-to-year contract position, as opposed to a multi-year contract.
So let me ask this question about that. Let's say you were to lose this election, okay? Do you have plans to a desire to teach at Syracuse University in an upcoming semester or in this area? Where are you going from here?
Well, I'm staying here. This is my home and I live here. Whether or not I would teach at Syracuse University, I don't know. Partly that's up to the university. But my intention is to be serving this district in Congress come January.
Okay. And let's set down your life path as it relates to being in Syracuse, because that has also been something that's been part of this messaging. Could you just describe to me your first association with Syracuse, when you started to live here, any breaks in that time, and the nature of your current commitment to this area? Just let's just sort of get that straight.
Sure. And I want to be clear about the fact that this is something I've talked about since I started this campaign. I've talked to the press about it many times. I've talked to voters about it many times. The congressman has put a good deal of effort into trying to make people think that I'm hiding things, which is, of course, not true. So I moved to Syracuse in 2003. I came here for the Maxwell School to study here. And I had a very serious injury. I had a head injury, which resulted in a very serious concussion and led to some significant health problems. And by the time 2007 came around, I was no longer able to take care of myself because of that injury and the issues that came from it. So I moved to Pennsylvania to live with my sister's family. They were living in Pennsylvania at the time. I spent 3 years there recovering, working on getting better. And then I spent 2 years in Florida.
So that's 2007 to 2010. Now we're 2010 to
2012,
roughly. Okay.
Yes, in Florida with my nephew, who was a teenager at the time. He has been a golfer since he was in the crib. And he wanted to move to Florida so he could play golf year-round in preparation for college. He was trying to get into a good golf school. I'm very proud to say he ended up going to Wake Forest and playing on one of the best teams in the country. So I lived there with him for 2 years until I was finally well enough to sort of resume my regular life. And as soon as I was well enough, I moved back here because this is my home. Bought a house, have been here ever since, and fully intend to remain here.
Now, did I read somewhere, hear somewhere that your mother lives in this house with you? Is that correct?
No, we co-own the house. She doesn't
live
here.
That's what I saw. Okay. All right. So you mentioned your time in Florida. This is another thing I wanted to ask you about in terms of the messaging from the congressman's campaign. There's an ad he's got out, and it's one of his, about you living the life of Riley in Florida and also not paying your taxes. Mm-hmm. So describe your living situation there in a little more detail. What kind of place was this, and what happened with the tax issue? Mm-hmm.
So, yes, this is one of the ads I hear the most about from voters who are angry about it. So the ad that you're referring to, I think it's useful to point out, was fact-checked by both the Post Standard and the Citizen and found to be largely false and misleading, although the congressman still insists it's accurate and refuses to pull it from the air. The condo that I lived in was my brother's condo. As I said, I was living there to take care of my nephew. And that was my brother's condo. The photograph that they show in the ad when they say that I lived in a mansion in Florida was a photograph of the community pool in the condo complex where I lived. And the issue about the taxes that the congressman is trying to make something of, I tried to run a small business, turn a hobby of mine, restoring junk that I'd find at flea markets. I tried to turn that into a business. I wasn't successful. But I owed $47 in taxes on that business that I was unaware were late.
This is business income or sales tax?
Yes, it was sales tax.
Sales tax. Okay,
yeah. And I was unaware that I had this outstanding tax that I owed when I got the notice. I paid it. I also paid a fine for paying it late. And so the total amount that I ended up paying was somewhere around $111 or something like that. And, you know, what is sort of extraordinary to me about the fact that the congressman chose to make an issue out of that is that he himself had a tax lien on his Virginia condo. He has also consistently over the years paid his property taxes here in the state of New York late. The one time he didn't was this year after he passed the GOP tax bill when he paid them early because he knew he was going to be penalized under the new bill. So it was surprising to me that he decided to make an issue out of that. But I think the overall effect of what he's going for is to try and suggest that I'm somehow lying or hiding things, which I'm not. And, I think it's really unfortunate that he's chosen to take this path in the campaign. It doesn't surprise me because I've seen his previous campaigns, but I think our voters deserve better.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Dana Balter, Democratic candidate for Congress in New York's 24th congressional district. I'm going to stick with the messaging just a little bit longer. And on the condo particularly, just describe to me very briefly, specifically, what kind of condo is this? How many bedrooms? What are we talking about here?
It was a sort of a 2.5-bedroom, 2-bedroom plus a den, which okay. I guess could or could not be considered a bedroom.
Okay. That's good enough. I just wanted to get that clear. And then there's another ad I wanted to ask you about from the campaign. This one might be from the RNC, but I believe it's also from the congressman's campaign. Maybe you can clarify that for me. It's an ad that has a mother and a child together in a room while the mother hears on the phone that some important medical procedure will not be covered by insurance if you and your fellow Democrats have been able to change the health care system. What changes in the nation's current health care system are you advocating for?
So I'm glad you brought up that ad, because while I am, you know, saddened by the congressman's choice to attack me personally, what makes me angry is his choice and his supporters' choices to use the tactic of fear-mongering to scare voters about something as important as health care. And that commercial suggests that somehow my plan for health care is going to mean that sick children can't see doctors.
So let's talk about this. What changes in the country's current healthcare system? Let's take it as it currently stands. What changes are you advocating?
So what I'm advocating for is exactly the opposite of that, to make sure that every child can see a doctor, that every person can see a doctor. I believe the best way to do that is to take our currently successful program of Medicare, which is effective and efficient and incredibly popular. Right now, Medicare only insures the most difficult to insure people, the elderly and those with long-term disability. Those are the hardest to cover and the most expensive to cover. What I'm advocating for is opening the doors of our current Medicare system to everybody, so that we are also covering the less expensive people to insure, the easier people to insure. What that will mean is that every single person in this country will have insurance and access to care. They will be able to see a doctor when they need to. They will be able to afford their medications, which right now is not the case for far too many of our families. It is a plan that will save us money, both in terms of our overall health care costs in this country, but also at the individual household level. 95% of households under a Medicare for All system will spend less money out of pocket on health coverage. Because right now, the things that they're drowning in, like premiums and deductibles, those will either get reduced significantly or disappear altogether, depending on the details of the plan.
So that plan, I think it's fair to say, at least in the next 2 years, is not going to go anywhere. There's no way that President Trump would sign that into law, even if the Congress could pass it. And that's probably unlikely as well. So are there other smaller changes that you are advocating that you can articulate briefly that are more relevant for the next 2 years?
Absolutely. And let me say about the two-year timeline, even if President Trump were willing to sign it into law, I don't think it would be ready within 2 years. I think we have a lot of work to do to very thoughtfully and carefully craft a Medicare for All bill that's going to be successful, and that will take some time. So in the meantime, there are a lot of things we can do. I think the first thing we have to do is allow Medicare to negotiate with drug companies. One of the biggest cost drivers in our out-of-control healthcare system is pharmaceutical costs. And in our current system, we see the VA negotiate with drug companies, and they save about 40% on the costs of medications. I want to see those savings be available to every American. So that would be the first step. The second is we need to repair the damage done to the ACA over the last couple of years and shore up that program, help strengthen the individual markets, encourage more states to participate in Medicaid expansion, because we see much better outcomes in the states that did than the states that didn't. So we need to work on that as well while we're working toward the longer term goal of Medicare for All.
You're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Dana Balter. She's a Democrat challenging incumbent Congressman John Katko for the seat in New York's 24th Congressional District. Again, we had originally hoped that this would be a debate between Ms. Balter and Congressman Katko, but he declined our invitation, so I am just speaking with Ms. Balter. All right, I want to stick with the messaging for a bit longer because I really think this is an important issue for our political system. The last one of these ads that I wanted to ask you about from his end, and then I have some questions about your claims, concerns the political group that your candidacy emerged from, the CNY Solidarity Coalition. It's a local version of the broader resistance movement against President Trump. His office has called this group, quote, radical, end quote, quote, a hostile and bitterly partisan activist organization that Dana Balter has helped create and grow right here in Syracuse, end quote. One particular focus of this criticism of your association with this regards the claim that the group protested Lockheed Martin in Syracuse. It's a local employer. And that you are being called upon to disavow this group's activity in this regard. How would you describe the group, first of all, if you can, briefly? I know that's a longer story, but briefly describe the group. And do you support the protest that it made at Lockheed Martin?
Yeah, so this is another case where the congressman is really sort of distorting the truth to scare people. So the organization that we're talking about here is a group of concerned citizens. As you said, it's part of a broader movement across the country. A lot of people are familiar with the name Indivisible as sort of an organizing umbrella for thousands of groups of concerned citizens across the country. And it's people who are coming together to exercise their First Amendment rights, to petition their government, and speak up for the things that they believe in and against the things that they don't. I think that is one of the most important things about being a citizen in a democracy, is that we can do that. The specific protest that he's talking about, I wasn't a part of. So I actually found out about it when he made this statement. But I think it's another example of him mischaracterizing what was happening. The protest was not against hardworking men and women. And of course, I support our hardworking men and women here in Syracuse. That protest, from my understanding, again, looking at it after the fact, was about the war in Yemen and had nothing to do with the employees of Lockheed Martin. But as
they,
I said, I wasn't
there.
They
located the protest there because Lockheed Martin builds some of the weapons that are used in that? Is that the connection?
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay.
I only know from looking at the event after the fact.
Well, let's just ask the question then. All right, you looked at it after the fact. Do you support that protest or not support that protest or have some other opinion on it?
I support people's right to participate in free speech and exercise the First Amendment. That's, in theory, that's what we all get into public service for, is protecting those fundamental rights that we have as Americans.
Okay. Now I want to ask you about some of your claims, or some being made by the Democratic Party on your behalf. First of all, the main theme of your critical message, I think, is pretty clear, and that is, and these are my words now, despite my words to describe what I think your campaign's claim is, that despite appearances, Congressman Katko is really not that moderate and is, in fact, more like other Republicans than not and goes along with President Trump most of the time. One assertion in that regard that's been put forward in support of this is that he has voted 90% of the time with Donald Trump and Washington's special interests. That's a quote from a mailer. Now, the problem with that kind of claim, from the standpoint of the political scientist that I am, is that a lot of those votes that are being counted there are either non-controversial or relatively insignificant items, such as the naming of a building, that kind of thing. And we've talked about this before when we had our individual interview earlier in the cycle. There are a lot of other facts that would point against this claim of yours in looking at the congressman's record. First of all, independent rankings of members of Congress consistently find Congressman Katko among the most moderate, independent, and bipartisan members. His bills have Democratic co-sponsors. That's a fact. And he's passed a lot of legislation for someone at his rank. It's another fact in his time of office so far. So tell me, if you can briefly, what are you really basing that argument on? Is it primarily a focus on the tax bill vote? What's driving this argument of yours?
It's his overall record. And I think that looking at the 90% statistic is a good initial guide. That comes from 538.com. They take out when they figure this statistic out, which they do for all members of Congress, and this is a nonpartisan site, they take out a lot of the non-controversial and unimportant things. Their focus is on substantive issues, which is important because some of the other rankings that the congressman cites don't do that. And they include a lot of things that are done to pad the statistics, and that makes him and others look more moderate or more independent than they actually are. 538's reporting on this is pretty good. But if we dig into his votes, we can see very clearly that he is not the moderate that he claims to be. He told us when he first started running for office in 2014 that he's a fiscal conservative and a social conservative. In his own words, he said that. And his voting record shows us. The tax bill was a party line vote. He has a terrible record on environmental issues, just like the rest of his party does, doing things like voting to dump coal ash in our streams and allowing pesticides and toxins and chemicals in our water supply. He campaigned saying that he would never vote to defund Planned Parenthood. And his first year in office, he did it four times. He is a co-sponsor of the Concealed Carry Reciprocity Act. That is an NRA bill that our own law enforcement community tells us makes us less safe. And on the rare occasion that he actually does vote against his party, it's a matter of political convenience. It's when his party doesn't need his vote, and so he is allowed to vote against to come back here and tell us. And one of the votes that he holds up as sort of his greatest badge of independence was his vote against his party on the Republican health care bill. Because he said to us, I will never repeal the ACA without a good replacement. He voted against that bill, but then he voted for the tax bill, which was a backdoor way to accomplish the same thing. Because in the tax bill, they killed the key provision of the ACA that made the entire thing work. And so,
well, let's specify what that was. What was that provision?
It was the so-called individual mandate that requires people to have insurance.
And it was, I think, more specifically than that. Correct me if I'm wrong. It was the penalty, the financial penalty that's assessed if you do not have insurance. That's what was removed.
Yes. Okay. And as a result of that, we saw a couple of things happen sort of as a direct result of that that are really important. One, premiums started going through the roof. And we saw state after state after state release numbers of what all of their insurers were going to do with premiums in the next year. And right here in our district, we saw our largest insurer announce that they were asking for premium increases of 39% next year. That kind of an increase throws thousands of people off insurance. The second thing that happened that may be even more concerning is this lawsuit that we're seeing in Texas, where 20 GOP-led states are suing the federal government saying, now that you've taken out this key provision of the ACA, the rest of the bill is invalid. And so we are now seeing challenges to all the other provisions that we need, right? The ability to stay on your parents' insurance till you're 26, the ban on discriminating against women and charging them more for health care, the ban on lifetime caps, so babies who are born and have to go in a NICU may reach their lifetime insurance cap before they even make it home out of the hospital, and most importantly, a threat to coverage for people with pre-existing conditions. And in our district alone, that's almost 300,000 people under the age of 65, right? All of that is a direct result of that vote on the tax bill. This is anything but a moderate agenda.
If you just joined us, you're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is Dana Balter, Democratic candidate for Congress in New York's 24th Congressional District. One follow-up on that, if you could briefly, because I want to try to squeeze some other questions in. But what is exactly the connection that you are arguing between the vote to or the repeal? Let's just take the policy, the repeal of the financial penalty attached to not having insurance. So that was part of the ACA and the rising premiums. What is that connection? Because I don't think it's obvious on its face. Why would that trigger rising premiums? One might argue, I think, that those rising premiums are part of a more general problem in our healthcare system and are being driven by bigger forces than that. What is that connection?
So it's true that premiums would have risen anyway, but they would have risen by very small amounts. They rise every year because our healthcare costs generally are rising every year. I say that there is a connection there because the insurance companies say that there is a connection there.
Why would they take that and say, oh, now we have to raise premiums?
Because by removing the individual, by removing the penalty, that means that people who were buying insurance but felt that they didn't necessarily need it, right? So young people, healthy people, people who are not worried about getting sick, will stop buying that insurance because now there's no longer penalty if they don't. And that separates...
So the pool gets sicker.
Exactly. That separates us into two risk pools.
Okay.
And we're left with the same kind of high-risk pool, which the congressman advocates going back to, that we had before the ACA. And that's what drives everybody's costs up.
Okay. There's another major theme of your messaging is that the congressman hasn't made himself available to the public. It was part of your original rollout of your campaign and has refused to participate in public forums where he might be challenged by people. So what's your evidence for this? I mean, briefly, what's your evidence for this?
You know, I was part of an effort that went on for many months trying to get him to hold public town hall meetings after Donald Trump's election so that we could talk about some of these issues that our voters and residents here in the 24th district are really worried about. He flat out refused to participate in any of those things. He doesn't do open public town hall meetings despite
What about these panels,
promising.
Though? Like panels on the opioid crisis, and you know, they're open, as far as I understand, and people come and ask questions. Tell me why that's not a genuine confrontation or openness to possible confrontation by members
so,
of the public.
So one reason is that they are single issue focused. They are also expert panels, right, who are talking about things as opposed to a discussion with the congressman. And he's done a number of them over the years. And when he says, and then we'll open up for questions, what I have seen is one or two questions at the end. And with very few exceptions, always on the topic of that he has announced. So the difference is between this hyper-controlled environment and something that is a truly open conversation about the things that the voters are concerned about and want to talk to him about. And it's a pattern with him. It's not just about not having those meetings. It's also about calling his office to ask a question about where the congressman stands and consistently getting the answer, I can't share that information with you, or I don't know. There is a very troubling lack of communication between him and his constituents.
That's unfortunately all the time we have for the broadcast portion of this. The campaign messaging has given us a lot to work with, but there will also be a continuation of this conversation that our listeners can find on WRVO's website, where we will discuss more issues and how you would go about trying to represent the 24th District should you be elected. That was Dana Balter. Dana, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thanks for having me.
For a continuation of the conversation you've just heard, please go to WRVO.org, and please tune in again to WRVO Public Media for more conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.